This is a recording from Reunions Weekend 2011 at the University of Virginia, made possible by the UVA Alumni Association. This session is The Rise of the Pacific Powers, Economic and Foreign Relations in the Coming Years.
I'm Richard Marks from the class of 66. Welcome to the second of our three megatrends seminars. This one is on the rise of the Pacific powers. We spent a lot of time on the title. And they've spent a lot of time on the content.
Welcome, everyone, and all who are straggling in after last night. We hope the crowd will increase gradually. As Richard said, the subject for this morning's panel is the rise of Pacific powers, drawing on a distinguished panel from the university's Darden School of Business and the Department of Politics. So let me briefly introduce our panel. Alan R. Bekenstein is professor of business administration and the coordinator of Darden's Global Economies and Markets area. His research and teaching address the impact of public policy on business decision-making. This has included the investment and operating environments in East Asia from the perspective of foreign corporations. He's been on the Darden faculty since 1972. Wei Li, professor of business administration. He also teaches in the Global Economies and Markets program with a focus on public finance, industrial organization, and international economics. His areas of expertise include Chinese business and economy and emerging markets. And at the end of the panel here, last but not least, Leonard Chopa, professor and associate chair, Department of Politics. And Len's areas of interest are political economy, institutions, and public policy in East Asia, with an emphasis on Japanese party politics, its system of social protection, and the role of foreign pressure in economics policymaking. Following the panelists' presentation, we'll open the floor to question and answers. And now I'll turn over the floor and the microphone and the video to Professor Bekenstein. Alan?
Thanks. Let me turn on this. We have 15 minutes each on a very broad subject, so we decided to, between the three of us, we complemented one another ably guided by Jim, and so we're each going to bring a perspective. My perspective is not as an expert in any of the countries there, but rather I've spent a fair amount of time in research, case writing, and consulting relationships with companies from elsewhere who've invested in East Asia, particularly China. So I want to kind of cast a view on China to start with from the point of view of outside investors, which gives you a bit of a look at strengths and weaknesses, perhaps, at least from their point of view. And then I want to, in a complementary way, look at the economic geography of China around these issues, because I think there's some really interesting things which portend at least tensions and trying to understand a bit about what drives China and how they might direct some of their policy. So I'll start with the outside investors. Outside investors are attracted to China largely because it's an enormous market and its rapid growth rate means it's going to get larger and larger. Now, for many people, that means that it's the middle class that they're interested in selling Western products to. And you've all read, I'm sure, how fast the middle class is growing in China. And even if the percentage isn't high, when you have 1.4 billion people, even a modest percentage is a pretty big number. But in addition, a lot of high-tech companies are discovering also, particularly in the last 10 years, that China, along with India, become a platform for operating, for innovating, particularly to what are called the bottom of the pyramid product range. So it's really hard to do that if you're Microsoft from Redmond, Washington, and say, gee, what would people in emerging markets need? It's another thing to be deeply immersed in China or in India and collaborate with people there and truly get a deep understanding of those markets. So both of those are going on, and it's a large place. There's room for both. Not on my list, but since I did this quickly, but there's an enormous talent pool in China. The education is high, the skills are high, and again, a big base. And those who came in early and are still coming in early are able to cherry pick some incredible talent. So I really should have had that on one of the bullet points. The other thing, you know, you hear lots of talk about the difficulties of dealing with the government or state-owned enterprise partners or whatever, which is true, but the clout that the government has with a lot of tight control allows you to do things that you couldn't do in a Western country or in many other more politically complicated emerging markets. They can turn a deal. I was telling my colleagues at lunch yesterday about I visited a large Marriott, a 1,300 room Marriott that went from concept to being completely built in 2 years in Beijing. 1,300 room, they knocked down low cost housing to do it. Imagine just the first 5 years of legal bills trying to do that in the United States. So if you have the right partner, and if you develop the right relationships, you can actually get some things done very efficiently. And that also is attractive for multinational corporations. Those companies that will bring a lot to the country and not exploit it, but actually help develop it, can develop a lot of, the popular word is guanxi. Wei can do a better translation, but since it's his native tongue, but essentially relationships, and they're very, very important. And I'll relate that a little earlier to why you don't want to be a late mover. There are other considerations. Many government and SOE partners, while having a lot of clout, are also very difficult to work with. They often don't address the questions. I've dealt with senior executives who work with them and they walk out pulling their hair out. And Chinese are very effective negotiators, but we have to be careful because we can't really stereotype 1.4 billion people. So there's a wide range. Pollution problems are enormous. I remember staying in a Marriott at Tomorrow Square in Shanghai, and 3 days later I could see the other side of the square because the pollution and the smog was so horrendous. I know a number of friends and former students who've worked in some of these places, Hong Kong included, who don't want to stay long because they think it'll shorten their life expectancy because the air quality is so bad. It's a serious concern. And these are issues that have to be solved. Transparency is low. The quality of data is not trusted by others. Do you believe Chinese GDP rates? On the other hand, I say, do you believe our GDP data either? And can you imagine just the problem of doing a census in China? It's at 1.4 billion, give or take a few tenths of a billion. It's just a horrendous problem. But they generally don't believe it. And this extends particularly to the quality of financial reporting, where global standards have been applied. But most people I talk to don't use the numbers. They have to do their own independent work if they're going to make an acquisition or form a partnership. Because they just it's lower than you would expect, compared to a lot of other emerging markets. There's obviously asset bubbles in both property and in equities. They've had some ups and downs, some big swings. But of course, if you don't really know the quality of earnings, if you don't trust the earnings ratios, then how do you evaluate? How do you trust the valuation? But some of this has to do with the investment options of domestic Chinese who aren't officially allowed to take their money out, although many find ways to do it. But should these bubbles collapse, obviously, like our own global financial crisis, there could be implications for investing there. Economic policies, I think Wei will touch this more, but some of them, like the yuan policy, have been probably unsustainable, but work real well for China, and they're kind of locked into it. Don't have time to really go into that, but people worry about that. And then, in particular, I've done some work with the world's largest dairy exporter who own called Fonterra. It's a New Zealand company, once known as the New Zealand Dairy Board. they own 30% of one of those domestic Chinese milk companies that had the melamine scare, and complete disregard for human safety, human health. And this is a problem, but there's a revolution taking place rather quickly over that and in product safety issues and general quality issues. There's a real different mindset between the domestic Chinese and these Western companies. On the other hand, I would suggest that it doesn't look that much different than the United States 100 years ago. And so it's probably not remarkable in that sense. But nonetheless, if you're going to collaborate and have a relationship, you have to get a little more oversight and control if you're going to sell these products in the West. The last comment there is some of this comes from enormously fast urbanization of former peasants or people from remote regions who have completely different notions of health and sanitation and things just based on where they came from. And the same was true in the U.S. when we went through similar things. It's just China's done it so much faster. So now if we look at some of these, a couple of other things, and this get us quickly toward the economic geography and with political implications for China. The natural resource requirements of China with a huge population and the growth rate are unbelievably enormous. And since they're very focused on having a steady rate of growth and being very stable, most of their relationships in the region and extending it perhaps through Central Asia and Southern Asia relates to the natural resource question and the procurement of those natural resources. And India, growing just about as rapidly as China now and over a billion people, adds to that. So the competition for resources is great. And I think this can't help but have a lot of consequences. The need to explore and extract from rather remote regions have changed things. So, for example, Central Asia, obviously relationships with the Persian Gulf, relationships with Iran. Comment at the bottom actually is relevant here. Note that their relationship have much more to do with practicality and economics than they do about ideology or form of government. So the idea that if we interpret what China is doing by having a relationship with the rogue government of Iran, it's pretty practical. And they don't tend to shape their relationships in ways that we do, which are much more about our political system or our economic system, and much more ideological. The stands, as we call, right, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, some of those, there's pipelines running across Western China all the way over to locations for natural gas and petroleum. Some of these are going to go through Pakistan or Afghanistan. It's rather precarious territory, and their relationships there have to be cultivated for economic reasons. The province of Xinjiang is one which has a significant you guys told me how to pronounce it, and I forgot. A Uyghur minority. Obviously, they're not going to take over. The Han Chinese outnumber them, and the government has firm control. But it's not particularly stable. Look at Tibet, which is everybody knows about, and the competition for hegemony in that area with Myanmar, which has access to offshore drilling, and Burma and Bangladesh and Tibet, Nepal, Bhutan. There are some significant mineral resources in those areas as well as access. And that whole area and the competition for resources with India is going to be interesting. And India hosts the Dalai Lama in exile. This whole thing. I'm not suggesting, nor am I expert enough to say Tibet or Xinjiang would fall in any way, but there are going to be some precarious issues there. So the geography is important. Go north to East Russia, which is pretty far away from the main government, competes with China and Mongolia for very significant resources. That is going to be an interesting political question. The Korean Peninsula, North Carolina, they're our football and basketball opponent. North Korea, when Dean Smith was there, there's similarities, but not anymore. North Korea is an embarrassment. It's a relationship they have, but South Koreans are very effective in China. They're some and elsewhere in Asia. They're very effective at partnering and really getting deeply immersed and been very successful. And a Chinese-South Korean relationship could grow, that could find the way to reunify the Korean Peninsula. And what does that mean? Does that mean U.S. troops leave the peninsula, or and what does that have to do with the politics? So all of these are factors longer term. I'll skip the ASEAN regions, but Australia is interesting because of its vast resources. And you probably read a couple years ago or a year and a half ago, the Chinese were going to buy Rio Tinto, one of the big Australian mining companies. And actually, the Australian government actually approved the sale, but Rio Tinto pulled out. This India and China are out there acquiring resources. This practical Chinese will their foreign relationships will be molded a lot by those resource needs. And so it makes it hard to predict what will happen. China has prospered with foreign investors, but the nature of the decisions, the companies I've studied really take what we call a real options approach to investing in China. The size of the market, you can't afford not to be there. So just like you can take a financial option on some possible change in a market position, you can have a real option. You can invest even though it won't be profitable for a long time. You'll have costs, but it'll give you position. If we go back to the concept of Guanxi being a second or a fourth mover in a market when somebody else has been there 10 years developing deep relationships with a very stable government, and that's not just central government, but in the provinces and cities as well, means it's hard to overcome. So there's a tilt to being there. Sooner or later, you're going to have to be profitable. I don't know very many companies that are profitable in China. They're spending a lot of money for very important market positions and possibilities, but that's going to have to change. And will the international politics remain largely practical, as I described, or will other objectives or complexities exist, both within China? Will its political system develop in ways that create pressures, or exacerbated by the Indian competition for resources, or what other things might happen? And I'll skip the economic policies, expecting Wade to cover that. So that's my contribution.
Thanks, Al. And of course, during the heyday of North Carolina basketball, they did refer to him as Kim Dean Il.
Is that right? Okay, I missed that. Thank you.
Wade, would you like to continue?
Well, good morning. My talk will be mostly on the economics of China, and I'm going to focus primarily on the whys and why did China emerged and, or re-emerged. My experience in China has been comes from primarily from my research as well as my consulting engagement in China. And I would also like to share with you the fact that I live half of my life in China and half of my life in the United States. And so this is right about the sort of the point where my life is sort of evenly split in there. One of the things to start with, let's take a look of. This is a little fast. There we go. So, what have changed? there's lots of numbers on here, and what you see is that the GDP ranking 30 years ago, 11th, and today in second after the United States. Export ranking just basically skyrocketed, and China's becoming a some many people would call it a world factory. And the life expectancy has increased somewhat, and in fact quite dramatically. You know, it's increased life expectancy from 30 to 50 is actually quite easy. From 50 to 70 is actually very hard. Okay? And this all comes even in the case where the air is almost unbreathable, as Alan was talking about. So basically, you can think about humans are pretty hardy. You know, you can't kill them so easily. And the other way to think about it is that with income, a lot of diseases can be cured, and some diseases can be managed. Even when the air pollution is bad, people live longer. So this is, some people go to China and say this is not progress, but others look at lumber and say this is progress, and this is a debatable. Poverty reduction is significant. Income inequality has risen, but you know the number of rich people in China has risen significantly, and so China has the middle class is probably on the same size as the United States, you know, the middle class by Chinese standards. But there's still a significant amount of people in China, roughly about 50 million, which I would call the globally rich. Okay, and these are the guys who people who cost the property market in Beijing and Shanghai to surpass that of New York. Okay, and that's the there's so much wealth that have accumulated over the years, and foreign exchange reserves are huge, and that's not may not be a good thing. And what's really important is that China has become the AV of the world because it built this high-speed train. You know, President Obama wants it. He may not get it, but he wants it. The air transport has basically mushroomed in China. It was almost didn't exist. Cell phones today in China is more than one per adult in China. China basically moved from without phone to cell phone, bypassing that landline. The question I want to address is how do we make sense of all those changes? And you know, one of the two things we can do, we can compare historically with China in the past. Or second thing, we can compare with what we have today. You know, most people like to compare that with the United States. I'm a little hesitant to compare with the United States. You know, think about this. Even if China has grown significantly, and they should, because why should they grow? Because they need cars. They didn't have it. They need cell phones. They didn't have it before. And they need roads. They didn't have it. They need toilets. They didn't have it before. And when they build all this, and their growth rate is going to be phenomenal. And they have to grow because they were poor. If they continue to be poor, it would be the shame of the whole humankind. Not just shame on them. If Africa didn't become rich, it would be shame on humankind from a humanistic point of view. So it's a good thing that they are growing. So the question is, how do we make sense of all this? And let's compare. One thing I like to compare is with actually United States, not today, but United States during the Gilded Age. Okay. During the Gilded Age, we got some really industrialists to build gigantic mansions, right? And that mimic the old Europe. And that's where Americans, newer rich, want to emulate. And if you look at today China, the newer rich in China try to emulate not old Europe, but old United States. And, you know, we don't consider United States old, but you look at the building they build, it looked like a neoclassical American style, right? You know, America, of course, borrow from the Greeks and Romans, but the Chinese take them. And this is one of the local government buildings. And, you know, when I drive around China, and as I drive in the countryside, I can spot in the distance, say, wow, there's a White House. And it's all because the rich people said, well, you know, those are nice. I'd like to have that. And The most popular car in China is Buick, and you won't believe it. And if you think about, and if you think about it, it's the reason the Buick is so popular is because the first car the Chinese emperor has is a Buick. And you know, when the Chinese want a car manufacturer to invest in China, they went to GM, and GM said no, China will not, too poor, and so they didn't go. And then so the Chinese got the VW. And so the VW brought in the cars, you know, they make in Brazil, and it's the Santana, and you know, you today go to China to ride in a taxi, and in Shanghai, they're in Santanas. And then the second time around, you know, it's not the Chinese going to ask GM, it's GM locking the door and begging to let in. And then the Chinese let them in to be the second car manufacturer in China. And guess what? The most profitable division of whole GM is the China division, right? It's the, and it makes 2 million cars in China today. And it's all not exported, they're all sold in China. In fact, if you have a dealership in China, you will make so much money because you are selling cars higher than the manufacturer's suggested price because there are wait lists for your cars. Now, that wait list only exists, and what I remember is during the tech bubble, I was trying to buy a BMW, and one of the dealerships said, well, you know, that car has a 3-week wait list. And of course, I thought I was rich. It turns out everybody failed them to rich with the tech bubble going on. And that's just kind of a, it doesn't exist, you know, it doesn't last very long in the United States, but that the shortage of cars has lasted for, at least I can remember, 2 years, and it's still in shortage. People are still buying cars as if they were pancakes. And you know, buying apartments, houses, as if they were cabbages. It's really amazing. So what, one of the things is, that's just the on the side. The other thing you can think about the China and the compare with the United States is that behavior-wise, the business and the population is roughly comparable during the early years of development in the United States. You know, today we're concerned about IPR protection. We're concerned about product safety, and the same concern existed 120, 150 years ago in the United States. And we sort of solved those problems through lots of years of hard work, you know, that created the movements of what we call the progressives, and which put in government regulations and so on and so forth. And China is trying to emulate that same era to do it. And that's sort of a comparing the United States 100 and some years ago. Another way to look at this, compare China today with China historically. When I first came to the United States, my advisor told me that you need to learn English. And the best way to learn English is to use it. And the best way to use it is to take a class that's called civilization. So I went to the civilization class, and not knowing and what the content is going to be, but my initial thought is going to be half of the civilization class is going to be on Western civilization, you know, that Greek and Roman, you know, stuff. And then half would be on other civilizations, you know, including Chinese civilization. Then I went into the class, it's all about Western civilization. There's nothing about anything else. It didn't exist. And of course, that was back then. Today, you go to class, it would be called Western civilization. And that's, you know, at least some political correctness that's got into the curriculum. and so, you know, so this is what I learned, you know, from college. And and this is what I learned in China, in college in China. I put them together, and what you see is they are very comparable in many ways. And in many ways, the Chinese were far superior in terms of technology. And during Song Dynasty, you know, as economists, I love to talk about economists. The things that economists love about is that human invention. The most important human invention is money. And during the Song Dynasty, the Chinese had started using paper money. And of course, the Song found out that once you start using paper money, you get hyperinflation. And so they had the first experience hyperinflation. And Song Dynasty also had, you know, they also have gunpowder, and they started using gunpowder and in firearms, but they were not enough to stop the Mongol invasion. So you can think, since about 1800, China began to relative decline. And so if you think about this, the Chinese being a poor country, relatively short. It's historically, it's about 200 to 300 years. In a large scale, 3,000 year history, that's nothing. You know, it affects personal lives very significantly. When I first came to the United States, I went to the store and trying to buy some pants because my advisor's wife told me that my pants, my wardrobe does not look good. So I have to go, you know, I went to the department store and then they measured me and I said, boys department. And I took care of that in 2 years, you know. When I was growing up, there was just not enough to eat. And when I consider China back then in the 1970s and early 1980s, China is very much similar to what North Korea is today. So the question is, what do you explain all these changes? So after we make sense of all those changes, I'm trying to explain those changes. And so what am I going to focus on policy making? And not on policy, but on policy making. I'll explain why. To me, the explaining why is actually easy. Explaining why not is much harder. So why not is the question is, sort of why didn't China develop? You know, if you think, you look around the world, Chinese population anywhere else in the world are not poor, except in China. Right? If you look at Hong Kong, you look at Taiwan, you look at Singapore, you look at the Chinese Americans, they're not poor. You know, they don't need government subsidies in general. You know, this is not to generalize totally. So the question is, how did China not grow? And that's a much harder question. I'm not going to explain. I'm going to explain why they developed. Okay, but I think the other one is much more interesting. One of the things to understand is the Chinese Communist Party has a survival instinct. They have to survive. And think, rewind your clock back to the late 1970s. They are as concerned as the Kim's family in North Korea. They want to survive. And they realize they become irrelevant. They have to become relevant again. And so the notion was to abandon the sort of ideology, to adopt a new ideology, which I call the GDPism. Whatever develops is good. After Deng Xiaoping, his successor, Jiang Zemin, made it even more extreme. Basically, he said, the Communist Party represents most advanced productive forces. But think about it, what's the most advanced productive forces? That's capitalists. So Communist Party now represents capitalism and capitalists. Okay. Now, the second thing, the orientation Chinese advanced culture. So capitalism, so the Communist Party also represents that elite in China, okay? The intellectual, the elite, the capitalists. And then the fourth one is, now the Communist Party not just represents the party's interests, it represents the whole people's interests. So this basically, the three represents, by Jiang Zemin, basically what I think is made what I call the sort of the demystification of Communist Party. And he made Communist Party, the religion become, they abandoned the religion, they have becoming secularized. Okay. So that's the first of the change that came along, and I think it's significant. Here's a poster that posted by the government in the local government. Local government basically says, the boss equals productivity, and productivity is good. Right. The other thing about the policy making we can go through lots of policies, but I think it's very important to realize that Deng Xiaoping and all his comrades, colleagues, don't know how to make China rich. So what are they going to do? But they do understand. One way to adopt good policy is to have to develop a method for adopting good policy. The method of adopting good policy is a scientific method. Scientific method is we know in college is that scientific method is that which enable you to move from unknown to known. And how do you do that? You do experiments. You don't know whether things works. You do experiment, you'll learn. And so that's what the Chinese did. They did all those experiments. I listed 1, 2, 3, and 6. I'm not going to go through all of them. Like, I'm going to focus on one. So one of these is opening up of China. China used to be very closed. You know, there's no exports and imports, and people can't travel outside of China. Foreigners can't easily go in. And so in order to develop, you look at the little places that near Hong Kong. There's a little fishing island, no, fishing village. It's across the river is Hong Kong. On this side of China is a fishing village. And call it fishing village is actually not an accurate description because the people there don't fish. They go to the river to pick up dead bodies. Why? Because there are so many people risking their lives crossing the river to go to Hong Kong. And then the border guards were shooting at them. So just the same thing like the North Koreans are trying to cross the river to go to China, and then the Korean border guards were killing them. And so the villagers make money by fishing people from the river and bury them, and for every body they bury, the government pay them. And that's their livelihood. Okay? And that's in the 60s and 70s. And you guys don't. And I will tell you a story. I went to a opening ceremony for a giant factory in Shenzhen. And then the CEO, the owner, was asked to make a presentation. 5 minutes onto the podium, he began to cry. And everybody was shocked. You know, this is a happy moment. Why is he crying? He began to tell a story that the reason he chose this site to build a factory was because his father was buried somewhere in here. His father and him were trying to cross the river to Hong Kong. He succeeded. His father was gunned down. And the only thing he knows is buried here. There's no markers of the tomb anymore. So he built that factory as a monument. Okay. And it's a lot of sad story, but it's and that's where the start is, to start with four the traditional treaty ports and to open. And Shenzhen is one of them. And open cities are doing very well, and they start opening more. And when those more opening turns out to be doing very well, they link them into bigger sort of processing, export, import zones, free trade zones. And finally, they made the whole island, Hailan, to be an open trade zone. This is Deng Xiaoping, who is inspecting the Shenzhen development. This is in the early 1980s. And today, Shenzhen would be a city that has 15 million people. Okay. So it's just built from ground up. The other thing is to think about how the Chinese have changed. It used to be a one-man rule, and it's now collective leadership, about 9 men at the vote. Increasingly, the vote today by the Communist Party is 5-4. So there are lots of conflicts within the party. And this is exactly what the party wants. The party wants to be relevant. The way to be relevant is to have competition. It doesn't want external competition, but it wants internal competition. Okay. So it's as if there is some kind of a check and balance within the party. And there's now, the Chinese government is very concerned about social stability. And one way to have social stability is to have some kind of a democracy, that people are upset and they can't blame the government. They can blame only they have to blame themselves for electing a guy who is corrupt. Right, so that's an important thing, to have some grassroots level of democracy. And we hope that this will progress up. Recently, I think there is slowing down in this political reform, and I think that's a significant. We'll talk about that, you know, if you guys are interested in that. Another reason China grew very, very quickly is that if you look at that in the 1990s, China is predominantly very young. There are a lot of people. You know, this is a population graph, and each bar represents the number of people. And yeah, as you go up, people die off. Okay. So 1990, very young. Today, middle aged. And that young people are who supplied the labor force for the factories. And they now become middle-aged, they become very skilled, and so they are moving up the value chain. The problem is China is going to be aging very rapidly. And that's 2010, last year, and 2050, as we predict. So if you, you know, many of you are, heard that in the United States we have problem with baby booming. You know, that baby booming in the United States is that little, you know, wave in the river. And these baby booming in China is a big tsunami. Okay. Now you've come, if you, you know, I don't have, I'm not showing the chart. You see the chart of the United States population distribution, and that baby boomer basically consists of a little bulge. Here he has a megaphone. That's cousin. So China is going to get old before it gets rich. And so it's a, an important thing to recognize that today China is growing 10% a year. In by 2050, China will likely to have negative growth. Okay, so it's better for them to grow fast now because you know, they can then take care of themselves later on. The yuan exchange rate, we have lots of discussion about that, but if you look at the yuan exchange rate, nominally it has appreciated about 25%, and this is done a few months ago, so it should have been about another 5% appreciation of the yuan. And real term, the yuan has appreciated more than 50%, okay, because the inflation in China is much higher. Okay. So the Chinese goods have become much more expensive. And so in the future, the United States will have to learn how to do manufacturing again. unfortunately. And the pollution will have to come back to the United States. Okay. So that's sort of a, if you look at the dependence of the United States and China, co-dependence, or what I call global dependence, is that basically Chinese work and save and export goods. You know, they work. But they save because, you know, you look at the population trend. They have to save for the retirement. There's nobody else to pay for them. Because there's a, for every retiree, there's only a quarter of the young people down there. So they have to save for their own. So they work and save, which means they work and make a lot of goods they don't consume today. And so all the goods they make must be exported. So they're exporting in the United States. And so they also they have lots of savings. What do they do with their savings? They don't invest totally in China. There's not enough investment opportunities. So they invest outside of China. They invest in the United States, mostly buying foreign exchange reserves and buying U.S. Treasury securities. And so basically, you can think about that is the Chinese are depositing money in the United States, okay? Buying Treasury securities as if they deposit money in the bank. And then the U.S. take the money. They fight wars in Afghanistan, the Chinese disapprove. Fight wars in Iran and Iraq, the Chinese didn't disapprove. But they, even though they disapprove, you know, verbally, but in action they says, you want to fight a war? Go ahead. Here's a bunch of money. And so they, you know, they do all that, and they, the United States then also consume the money that China lent to the United States, and the U.S. also invest in China. Now, when the U.S. invests in China, the GE's investment in China, I would estimate the return to be at least 25%. And the Chinese deposit in the United States earning about, at most, 5%. And so that's one of the reasons you look at this and say, well, the U.S. is like the bank. You know, the bank takes deposits and pay the depositor very little, and then invest in higher yielding assets. That's how the bank, so the U.S., you know, one of the reasons why, you know, many of our MBA students want to work in financial institutions because that makes a lot of money. Nobody wants to do the manufacturing. That may have to change in the future, but at least when, currently, the U.S. is basically the world banker, at least the banker of China. You know, when the Secretary Clinton said, you can't blame the banker. He's treating China as the banker, but the Chinese look at the United States, you are the banker, not me. I'm just a depositor, right? So this is interesting codependence between the United States and China. So that's As for the, and if any questions, I'll be happy to address. Thank you.
Thanks. Lynn, would you like to wrap it up on Japan? This.
Okay. This panel is called The Rise of Asia. And if Dean Wu were giving the presentation and talking about Korea, she could talk a lot more about the rise of another part of Asia. But when they substituted me for Dean Wu and asked me to speak about Japan, it's a little bit of a disjuncture because there isn't much of a story of the rise of Japan in the last 20 years. Of course, if you go back to the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, when many of you were in school, it was all about the rise of Japan. And much of what you heard about the rise of China, you could tell a very similar story about rise of Japan in that era. But for the last 20 years, we're seeing flatlining. And this is called megatrends. To me, the shocking thing on this graph, which looks at the GDP trends of Japan, the United States, and China, is not that China is rising or that the United States is rising. It's that Japan has flatlined. Since about 1995, the Japanese economy has not grown at all in terms of nominal GDP. Okay? So back in 1995, the Japanese economy had been growing steadily up to that point in nominal GDP to the point where it was 75% the size of the United States. With half the population, they were producing 75% of what we made. But since then, they've flatlined to the point that today, not only do they have less than half of our population, because the population trends have diverged, but they're now making only about one-third of what we make, annual production. Okay, so this is an interesting puzzle, not exactly about a rise, but it's very much connected to the rise of China story, because look what's happened in the last year. China has crossed the size of the Japanese. So in terms of developments in Asia, this is huge. After a century or so in which Japan was the number one country in Asia, in terms of economic size, they've now had to deal with the fact that they're now number two in Asia. And if China continues to grow at 10% and Japan stays growing at very little, China could be twice as big as Japan in 7 years. So imagine that your major regional rival, who has been smaller than you for as long as you remember, is suddenly going to be twice as big as you. This is the biggest thing going on in Japan's foreign relations. How are they going to adjust to that new reality? One more thing about this chart. China has been growing at 10% a year, and it's easy for Americans and others who think about this to say, oh, that's just a steady state. They've been growing 10% a year for a long time. We're just looking at something similar happening in the future. But when a Chinese economy that was small in 1990 grew at 10% a year, that was not a big effect on the local economy or the regional or world economy. When a China that's now as big as Japan doubles in size in 7 years, that's like adding everything that Japan consumes and makes in a given year to the world economy over the next 7 years. Okay, so this is we've heard about how this the resource constraint and some of the other things that are going to hit. It's going to become even more pronounced in the coming years because China is already large and it's continuing to grow at the same pace it has for the last 30 years. So my question, why has Japan stagnated for the last 15 or 20 years? I'll give you five answers, just a few minutes on each one. So I'm going to start with the one that we just heard about was part of the China story, demography. So the big mountain that you see there on the graph is the size of the population of 15 to 64-year-olds in Japan, so the productive population. A big reason that Japan grew at 10% a year in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was because their working age population was going up, steadily up and up and up. Meanwhile, they were having fewer and fewer children, going from having five kids a family to having two kids a family. And their number of old people was still very small. Up until 1990, Japan had a very youthful population. So they had the best of both worlds. Very few old and young people to support, large and growing number of working age people working and producing things. And that a big part of the story of why Japan has grown and why China has grown is because they've got this demographic bonus. that comes in while you're making this demographic transition, with your working age population becoming the biggest bulk of your population. What has happened in Japan since 2000 is that their working age population is shrinking. And they're going to lose 100 million, they're going to lose 35 million people as in the working age group as they make this transition up to 2050. So everything that worked for them, propelling their growth in the earlier boom years, is now working against them. As they have fewer and fewer workers, even if they can improve their productivity, it's going to be very hard for them to grow when your number of workers is shrinking. And meanwhile, they're supporting a growing number of elderly people. So Japan is experiencing what China is going to experience in 20 or 30 years, a period in which there are a shrinking number of young people and a large number of elderly people who are consuming health care and pensions. So you hear the scary numbers about Social Security in the United States, about how when the baby boomers get old, how are three workers going to support one retiree, or two and a half workers going to support one retiree, right? Those are the numbers people are warning you. Social Security is bound to go bankrupt, because how can that possibly work? Well, Japan is looking at a situation where they're going to have close to one worker for every retiree. One worker for every retiree. That's a huge financial burden on the working age population that is going to make it difficult, continually difficult for Japan to grow economically. There's some positive news for the United States here, though. Japan's percentage of the elderly today is the same as what the U.S. is projected to have in 2050. You know that scary year in 2050 when Social Security is going to go bankrupt, because how can we possibly afford it when you have 23% of the people who are over 65? Well, Japan has got 23% of their people who are over 65 today, and their pension system has not gone bankrupt. Their healthcare system is not bankrupt. Okay? So they're managing with the levels of aged people that the United States will see in the future. But it's questionable whether they can manage in terms of pensions and healthcare in 2050, when their numbers are going to be much more challenging. I don't want to say scary, because old people are a good thing, right? So we're all going to be old people. So demography is one of the reasons for Japan's challenges. I'm going to start. The second one is politics. I'm in the politics department. And my specialty is Japanese politics. It's a particularly interesting thing to study because it's so dysfunctional. And the main adjective that's used to describe Japanese politics is clientelistic. Okay? Most of what goes on in politics revolves around delivering monetary favors to privileged groups of voters, subsidizing farmers, protecting regulated industries in cozy arrangements that jack up the prices, and building lots of things, pork barrel projects. What you're seeing in this series of pictures here is three different bridges that the Japanese decided to construct to connect their least populated, least developed main island there to the main island of Honshu. You'd think they could have built just one to establish a trucking connection or something, but know that the pork barrel politics worked in such a way that they had to build three of these very grand and expensive bridges. They're having to charge $50 to toll to go across these bridges because that's the only way to make the financing work, and it doesn't work. Because when you charge $50, people start sending their materials on the ferry. The ferry is cheaper. And so the bridges are getting very little use, and they're losing money every year. And this is what's happening in a lot of this infrastructure that's been built in Japan in an effort to win elections for the ruling party. I'll come back to politics at the very end related to the earthquake. But you may know that in 2009, finally, Japan got a new party in charge. Up till then, you had the Liberal Democratic Party of Japan running the country virtually continuously since 1955. That was the party that perfected clientelism and building bridges and dams and things like that to win elections. And there was a lot of hope that this new party would come in and really have a different style of politics. But it hasn't changed in that way. The prime ministers, since they came, this party came to power, have continued to struggle, and they haven't really gotten rid of clientelism. So third problem is debt. And it's closely related to building bridges and dams and the kinds of things you just saw. But also it's related to having 20 years of economic stagnation. Since 1990, the Japanese government has spent many years trying to use fiscal policy, public works spending, borrowing to stimulate their economy and get them out of the doldrums. And the result after all these years is a huge mountain of debt equal to 200% of their GDP. Again, you hear the concern in the United States, oh my goodness, we're up to 80%. What are we going to do? How are we ever going to pay back this debt? The Japanese are dealing with a much larger issue. The footnote there is that the United States is having to borrow internationally a lot of the money that is funding our debt. The Japanese have managed to finance most of this red ink with their own savings. So the Japanese people, the government owes the Japanese people 200% of GDP, which is better than owing foreigners that much. But on the other hand, you still got to figure out how the government is going to pay back this money while covering the pensions and health care of the aging baby boomers. So these are the kinds of fiscal challenges Japan is dealing with. So I think most of you have heard about those three issues of demography, debt, and even the clientelistic politics. But I'm going to emphasize another aspect that probably gets less attention, and that is the inability of the Japanese society, not just the politics, but the corporations, the whole society, to break out of structures that they created during the high growth years that are no longer working, that are dysfunctional. Japan is extremely conservative society in holding on to these kinds of structures. Among the things I'm talking about here are lifetime employment. Okay? Lifetime employment in Japan was a system where if you got hired as a factory worker, you could expect to work there until the end of your career. This was an important way in which people had stability in their lives, and it's naturally something that workers hesitate to give up. But this was something that worked okay when the economy was growing 10% a year. It's very difficult when your economy is shrinking to have a system that's trying to provide lifetime employment to a lot of workers. And it's a particularly difficult thing as you have a new generation of women rising up in Japan who are wanting to work and not just be full-time housewives, which was a career aspiration of the majority of women about 30 years ago. But it's not the career aspiration of a lot of Japanese young women today. And if they're going to deal with this aging baby boomer population in Japan, they're going to need a lot of people who are not currently working to enter the workforce. And the largest pool that's available is women who are staying at home and taking care of their families rather than trying to combine that in some way with working in the paid employment. The shocking number here is not so much the total numbers of Japanese women who are working. If you look at the 20s, you can see that lots of Japanese women do enter the workforce. 75% of women in those age groups are working. But by the time you enter the childbearing years, Japanese women leave the workforce in very large numbers, especially the full-time workforce, so that only about 25% of women in the peak childbearing years are working full-time. A fair number of those women who are working full-time do not have kids. Okay, they've made the choice. They're choosing work or staying at home with their kids. The Japanese society still has this male breadwinner structures, expects the women to do everything at home, and therefore makes it very difficult for them to combine that with employment. And this is a fundamental structure that the conservative society has been very hesitant to give up. Just a few more measures for you to look at and think about. Japan is considered the 57th ranked gender equal society. The United States comes in at number 18. Japan is way down there, way below even Costa Rica and Mexico. So In terms of the number of women who are working in managerial jobs, who are politicians, who are bureaucrats, there's a whole gender here that isn't being used in terms of productive employed work in Japan, and that's a problem they're going to have to solve, and they have been unable to do so. And that's driving fertility rates lower as those who want to work give up on having children, and shrinking the population who's employed as some of these women give up to have children. Okay, the other potential pool of Japanese workers who could solve some of their economic problems is to bring in a lot more immigrants. The Japanese, even today, have just 1.6% of their population who are foreign residents. And a significant portion of that, the blue line you see there, about 600,000, are Korean residents of Japan, many of whom are third or fourth generation. They're the descendants of Koreans who were brought to Japan before World War II and are still foreigners in Japanese society, even though they only speak Japanese and don't speak Korean. So Japan has a very small group of immigrants, even though their number of workers is shrinking and their economy is stuck in the doldrums, and many Japanese young people don't really want to do the dirty and particularly physically demanding kind of work that some immigrants would be willing to do. So the final challenge then is this earthquake. I know you've seen many pictures and heard all about this earthquake. Today, let me focus on the potential effects briefly on the economy. When the earthquake first happened, the economists generally said this is not going to be a huge economic deal for Japan. The Tohoku region that was affected by the economy, by the earthquake, was just 2% of the Japanese economy. It's smaller than Kobe, which had a major earthquake in 1995. When the Kobe earthquake happened, Japanese economic production dipped for two quarters, and then it more than made up the dip very quickly as Kobe rebuilt. And many people expect the same thing to happen in the Tohoku region. The first part of this has definitely happened. The Japanese economy shrank by 3.7% in the first quarter of this year. In the immediate effects of the earthquake shutting down a huge part of the country. And it's expected the economy will shrink some more in the second quarter. There is some hope I agree with the economists that there will be a rebound as the rebuilding begins to take place in Tohoku, and that shrinkage is going to end in the middle of this year. But there's some further unknowns that have developed, some further challenges that have developed in Japan as a result of the nuclear disaster. That is different from the Kobe earthquake, and it means that not only did Japan lose the Tohoku region damaged economies, but it has lost a huge part of its electric power that supplies Tokyo, a huge part of the Japanese economy. This summer, they're expecting that the amount of available electricity will be 15% below peak demand. So a lot of people are going to have to turn off their air conditioning, and a lot of factories are going to have to shut down in the middle of the day in the peak summer months to avoid brownouts and blackouts in Tokyo. And now that this tsunami has revealed the lack of earthquake preparation and tsunami preparation in a number of other nuclear power plants, another complex has been shut down, affecting the electric power supply in the central part of Japan to the east of Tokyo. And a lot of other nuclear power plants are shut down as well. So this energy challenge is going to be a lingering problem for Japan, because they have put all their eggs in the nuclear basket. They had counted on 50% of their electricity in 2050 coming from nuclear power. They did not invest in solar and wind alternative energies. They don't want to go back to coal. So the only alternative, in the short term, they're going to have a lot of power shortages until they can get maybe natural gas supplied electricity going again. But that's not going to solve their long-term energy problems. And the political leadership right now is completely stalemated over how to respond to this issue. Prime Minister Kan tried to get a recovery budget through the legislature and was blocked by the opposition parties, so they can't even agree on a recovery budget. And he faced this week a no-confidence motion, which he survived. But he's expected to resign in the next 6 months. Basically promised, in order to survive in the short term, he promised his party that he would step down in the next few months. And that guarantees more political instability and continuing challenges as Japan tries to recover from the earthquake. Thank you.
Thank you, Lane. The clock says we are about at 10:43. I know many of us, if not all of us, are going to President Sullivan's address in Old Kabul, so it's very close. We have time for maybe a couple questions, and there should be a mic available someplace right here, I think. Erica, if you'd raise your hand and let the mic come to you. Well, this gentleman right here in the blue.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed everyone's presentation. My question, I guess, would be for Wei Li. You know, as we and really for everybody, we've talked about the demographic trends in Asia, where societies are aging. Economically, the only answer would be an increase in productivity for the workers to achieve the sorts of gains that would be needed. How would you describe China's intellectual openness to becoming a global services player? So China right now is in a investment-led manufacturing growth phase, but eventually it'll have to become a knowledge-based, knowledge-driven economy. If I were to compare China to Japan or Korea, I'd say it's more intellectually open, but with Facebook being closed and with the education system being very parochial, and I wondered if you might comment on how China might make that transition from investment-led manufacturing growth to more knowledge-based services and to avoid the fate of Japan.
That's a very good question, and I think you mentioned about the closure of many of the internet portals that I think those were deliberate policies that made by the party for precise purpose of preventing the use of those portals for mass uprising. And it didn't sort of help when Google made it clear that it prefer people use their services for undermining dictatorships. And if I were a business, I would not say that. You know, people may use it for it, but I would not, you know, encourage people in doing that. And so I think today, if you count the number of trips that the Facebook's CEO is in China, Mr. Eckerberg, and he is trying to learn Chinese, and he's trying to position Facebook to be opened, accepted by Chinese government. So I think one of the things in there, I see two things. One is the Chinese needs to loosen up, right, and not to put so much control on things. The other thing is that I think the businesses in the West need to learn how to deal with concerns of the Chinese government. And the Chinese officials felt like there's no empathy to them, you know, as if sort of toppling the Chinese government is such a great thing. And, you know, today if we talk about toppling the U.S. government, I'd be sent to jail. And if I take actions to that, I certainly will go to jail. But toppling Chinese government seems to be cheered on. And it's sort of, and that's one of the things, we internally cheer on, but you know, as a business, we can do better in terms of trying to figure out a way that is beneficial to everyone, including the Chinese government. And I think on our second question is how does the Chinese innovation? I think China today is a very innovative society. People don't realize that. And it's really interesting because China become a world factory, not just because labor is cheap. Because as Chinese labor now has risen by more than three times cost, we don't see a lot of factories moving out of China, and that's the reason, because productivity has risen significantly, And, this, and there are infrastructures all built up and, to do that. And the other thing is that innovation in China takes place mostly in process. You know, China now can produce things much cheaper than anybody else, and it's higher quality or similar quality cheaper. And you know, people think of, in the West, we think about innovation in terms of, you know, coming up with iPhones, iPads, and design stuff like that. In China, innovation takes place mostly in process and how do I make things better.
I have one quick question and then we'll...
Okay, I have a question for Leonard. For all the political and economic dysfunctionality of Japan that you portrayed, isn't there like a broader mission they have around social stability that, you know, that really defines why they have oriented themselves in that way? When I think about the... you know, lower unemployment for so many years, lower crime, less out of wedlock children, you know, a tremendous social stability. We live in Manhattan. You can't have your child walk by themselves for two blocks in Japan. Kids, you see 7-year-old kids walking to school across the city. There's tremendous social dividend that they've enjoyed for 40 years of employment, less as a result of stable employment. They have, you know, they may have less divorces, less, all kinds of social benefits have accrued. And on the topic of immigration, I compare them to Holland or France and their entire sections of Paris where the police force won't even go into those sections because they're afraid for their own lives. So isn't there like a massive benefit, or is it just, you know, the political dysfunctionality has just gone on and they don't, they're not aspiring to something? And I just, you know, want to get your perspective on that.
I'm glad you mentioned the social benefits of this conservatism that I talked about. What they're holding on to is a social structure that's provided lots of people with income security and families with family stability and security from crime and all kinds of things that, that people all over the world worry about. And a big reason why they don't want to give all this up is because they value that tremendously. You ask the average Japanese person, do you want to change your trade, your life for life in the United States? And they're going to say no. They don't want to deal with our crime rates, divorce rates, the fear of children being endangered, and things like this that they value a great deal. And it's also because the Japanese people experienced poverty during World War II. Many of the people who built these structures, people who are still alive today, experienced a great deal of hunger in the immediate aftermath of World War II. They experienced some of the things that Professor Lee talked about, this young Chinese remembering. And so why would you want to go back to cutthroat Wild West capitalism that might put some people in that kind of position if you have a system that's providing a lot of stability? It's like many people liken the Japanese experience to the frog that's put into boiling water. It's boiling very slowly. It seems quite comfortable as the water is getting a little warmer. But the fiscal problems that I highlighted are eventually going to become unavoidable. So as long as Japanese people can buy all the government debt, they can continue to borrow a lot of money and keep the system afloat. But as the number of old people in Japan goes up, they're going to be dissaving in their retirement. And they won't be able to fund all of this debt. And at that point, will the foreigners want to gamble their money on Japanese government debt at low interest rates when the country owes 200% of GDP? Probably not. And that day is coming very soon when they're not going to have enough domestic savings to fund this debt and they have to go abroad for money. And the Chinese? Are the Chinese going to loan to the Japanese to keep their social stability afloat? We'll see.
Thank you, Len. I'm the committee. Let's give everyone on our panel a round of applause. And I want to thank all of you getting up at a relatively early hour to come out today. We appreciate the attendance and glad you could make it.